Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Dr. Jerry Bergman, he's taught biology, genetics, chemistry, biochemistry, anthropology, geology, microbiology at the college university level for 40 years. He has over 1,000 science publications to his credit, many of them translated in up to 12 different languages. What an honor to have back again Dr. Jerry Bergman to the studio. Welcome, Jerry.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, you were just here when we talked about your book, C.S. Lewis, Anti-Darwinist.
Mm-hmm.
And so now your latest book, How Darwinism Corrodes Morality.
Right.
This topic, it immediately angers evolutionists, liberals, leftists, and they take offense at it because they are Darwinists.
Right.
But the documentation that you provide that has come in through the decades, it seems to be uncontrovertible.
Oh, it's overwhelming. They deal with it by ignoring it or by name calling.
So morality itself, your first chapter in here, Darwin and Morality, I mean, absolute morality flows from God. So if you don't believe in God or you have an alternative worldview for origins, then basically we're animals.
Right. That's what they teach. Of course, we're animals. We're higher animals, maybe bigger brain. We walk upright, but we're basically animals.
And if in our schools we teach children that they're animals, which we do, we shouldn't be surprised when they act like animals.
Yeah, that is unfortunately a truism which does occur. Mm. In the chapter here on the relationship between Darwinism and morality, I quote a number of leading evolutionists who basically admit there's a connection. And basically, we're talking about sexual, by and large, immorality, at least what Christians would call immorality. And they're basically saying, if we are animals, then what's wrong with behaving like animals in some ways? Now, there are certain things that most Darwinists hold dear, and that is we shouldn't discriminate against certain races. You know, we shouldn't
Well, of course, that's true. That's biblical, too.
Yeah.
The book of Acts, we've all come from one blood.
Right. We should treat women well. That's
biblical.
Course, biblical as well.
Right.
So they have a hard time with us saying they don't have morals. Well, they have a set of morals. But part of that set of morals is basically the sexual morality. They feel that as animals, of course, are, and that's the example they use, as animals are immoral. If you have a dog, you know that they'll respond to just about any dog in the neighborhood when they're in heat. And so therefore, animals don't tend to be very fussy in who they copulate with. And they feel we're animals, so why should we be fussy?
So when Darwinists are in heat, they have no scruples about who they pair off with.
No scruples or less scruples. They would say, well, we don't believe in rape, of course, or many would.
Well, some would. Certainly not all.
Some would. That's true.
I mean, male dolphins, I've read, I haven't seen it for myself, but will virtually gang rape a female dolphin.
Yeah.
And that's animals. And if animals do these things, in fact, homosexuals have argued on my show, they've said, look, we see homosexual behavior in dogs and pigs and and if they're arguing that we are like pigs and dogs, I mean, I don't think their argument is bringing them where they really want to go.
Right.
Because they're just animals.
That's true, yeah. Of course, they wouldn't say just animals. They would say we're a higher animal, but we are. In the end, we are animals.
Are you giving them a little more credit than many of them? Many. I mean, I'm thinking of some specific evolutionist. We are just animals.
Yeah.
How about the phrase, a boy is a dog, is a pig, is a rat? I think that's from Steven Pinker. I don't want to misattribute it.
Yeah, I don't recall that specific quote, but yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so. All right, so they say that, well, Darwinism and morality, we're fundamentally animals. And so really, there's no such thing as absolute right or wrong in their worldview. So it's really just preference. Morality
right.
is a preference
right.
of an individual or a group.
They believe that we should develop our own morality. We should be free to be able to determine what's right and wrong. But of course, when one does that, then we end up with profound differences. Mm-hmm. And for society to coexist with other societies and even within the society, we need to have some standard that's agreed upon at what's appropriate and what's not appropriate.
Mm-hmm. There were 19 Swedish journalists came to Denver to cover the last presidential election, and I was honored that I got to speak with them. We went to the Brown Palace in the lobby downtown Denver, historic hotel. And we were talking about majority, the majority opinion, and they were of the opinion that the majority must be right. And so I asked them, well, how about owning blacks as slaves? Or how about the majority of Germans and their opinion of Jews? What you're saying really is that the strong or the majority can kill the weak or the minority.
Right.
It's as though they never thought about the possibility that the majority might be wrong. It was bizarre.
Yeah. Or they would say, well, in that case, they're wrong. But in many cases, they're not wrong. Mm. In many cases, and of course, with a lot of this behavior you mentioned, they look at the statistics, for example, like same-sex marriage. They would say, well, the majority now of people believe in same-sex marriage. So therefore
it's
got to be right. Got to be okay.
Right.
Can't argue against the majority.
No. And if the majority thought owning blacks was right, then so their arguments are facades. They fall apart. We have a video on YouTube called Get Out of the Matrix. I went to a college philosophy class and we videotaped it. It was for a full length class. I talked to them and I asked, is there such a thing as absolute right and absolute wrong? They say no. I asked the student in the cafeteria, it's on the video, was it absolutely wrong for the Nazis to murder 6 million Jews? She said no.
Yeah.
In the class, I asked the professor, is it absolutely wrong for a man to violently rape a woman? Is it absolutely wrong? The professor said, it depends on what you mean. And I said to her, ma'am, you are a fool. You're a fool.
Yeah.
So you write about Havelock Ellis, eugenics, the sexual revolution.
Havelock Ellis especially pushed what they call a new morality. The new morality basically is what they call an open marriage. Open marriage is basically where you and your wife have this agreement that indeed, if you meet this, you know, you have a new secretary and she's really sharp and you'd like to spend some time with her, and so you take her out to a motel and your wife says, oh, that's fine. The idea of open marriage is not that you cheat on your spouse, but you tell your spouse that you're cheating. You have an honest relationship. And they claim in their studies that they claim are valid, they claim that that actually improves your marriage.
Right. Absolutely. You want to have a great marriage, then just cheat.
And cheat,
Fool around.
But tell your wife you're doing so, so you're open and honest.
Be honest.
So obviously that doesn't work very well. And
Ayn Rand tried that.
And there are others that tried that. In fact, the O'Neill and O'Neill, who did the book Open Marriage, they had an open marriage and they ended up divorced. So that indicates what can happen in this.
Jerry, decades ago, I read that Atlas Shrugged, which Ayn Rand, she was an atheist who opposed liberal Christianity, the Christianity that's make-believe Christianity, but it's really liberalism.
Right.
Welfare and all. And so after I read the book, fascinating, looked into her life, and she advocated open marriage, and she insisted that her husband accept her affair with a married man. And she got both spouses to agree to the affair. And then, a few years later, her husband was attracted to a younger woman. She took a fit. She would have nothing to do with accepting his open marriage, just hers.
Yeah.
So, and she is the advocate of that worldview. I think Jesus is the only advocate of a worldview who actually lived it.
Yeah, that's true. It's okay for me, but not for you. And of course, women complain about this for eons. There's a double standard where what's behavior is okay for men is not okay for women. And then rightly so complain. They should complain because it is a double standard.
Yeah, and to God, he expects all of us to be moral and upright and decent and faithful.
Yeah, right.
Then you write about Alfred Kinsey.
Yeah, and he's an interesting guy. When I start reading more and more about him, of course, he is almost held up as an esteemed scientist. He taught at Indiana University, was a full professor, got his doctorate from Harvard University. And when I learned about his life and his lifestyle, I was really shocked. He is basically one of the people who basically brought about the new morality. And he did this by basically saying that immoral behavior, what we consider immoral, as Christians do, is common, and therefore it's okay. One of his strongest arguments was, indeed, behavior that's common must be okay. But his sampling technique that he used, he didn't try to get a random sample, he would interview people in prison, for example, men who were in prison for pedophilia or for other crimes. And his interviewed a lot of college students, which, of course, you're not going to look at typical morality from college students, especially when they're young, 18, 19, 20.
Unmarried.
On campus. And therefore on campus with...
binge drinking and all.
Yeah. And so therefore his statistics turn out to be not only wrong, but just irresponsible. But yet it got a lot of publicity, enormous amount of publicity.
Well, he's a hero today.
And many defended him. But there were some critiques of his work, very effective critiques, which show that his methodology was really, really very poor. Surprisingly, he basically interviewed biased groups like at gay bars. Of course, he's going to get a set of attitudes from people who frequent gay bars. That's quite in contrast to the average American.
Especially in the time when he was writing. He had to go to Greenwich Village in New York City or San Francisco.
Right.
Basically. He has, in his book, we've had on the show a couple programs, a Dr. Judith Reisman. Do you know her work?
Her work is very well done.
Yeah. She's a brilliant gal. One of her books, Soft Porn Plays Hardball, which is one of the reasons I get upset at people like Hugh Hewitt, nationally known Christian talk show host. He brags about all these porn channels that he watches, HBO, Cinemax, Game of Thrones. He just said 2 weeks ago, you know, his favorite Game of Thrones episode had just aired. This is Christian porn.
Yeah.
It's literally Christian porn. And Judith, she points out how destructive this is, but she then wrote about the children of Table 34. Kinsey had a table where he was doing research on the sexual activity of young children.
Yeah, or babies. Many of them were babies.
Babies and infants, toddlers.
Right.
And this is, I mean, it's a self-admitted child sex abuse.
Right.
Right.
And when I read that, I was surprised. But I have his book. I have the original copy of his book, The Sexual Behavior Among the American Male. And I looked on page 34, I believe it is, and there it was. Chart was black and white, and he described the behavior that he was trying to elicit from young children, basically sexual behavior among young. And when I say young, I mean quite young. I should have got
months,
a copy.
3 months, 6 months.
3 months,
I forget the
months.
Details. Yeah, right.
And as one of my, when I worked for Arlington Psychological Associates, one of my clients said, we call them clients rather than patients, it's more respectable, but one of my clients basically said, I didn't even know what sex was until I was like 13 or 14. And so people are, some are more obviously aware than others at that age. But on the other hand, how many 3, 4, 5, 6-year-olds really understand what sex is? They know what boys are. They know what girls are. They know boys and girls are different, but that's about
right.
All.
But now, because of the ubiquity of pornography, I mean, kids go to school and they have hardcore porn on their cell phones.
Yeah.
And they have it on their cable and satellite TVs at home. And they have it on their computers, their internet. So our children today are intensely sexualized at terribly young ages.
They are.
And it's affecting puberty, too, the onset of puberty.
And that can affect, ironically, when politicians do it. There's several cases about the congressman from New York, I believe, who I forget his name, but he was involved in displaying pictures of his sexual organs on the internet.
Oh, yeah, right.
And
I remember his name, but we'll leave it unsaid.
Then they really end up in trouble. And so to some degree, there's a double standard.
Mm-hmm.
And the double standard, I think, is what confuses people and what makes young people unsure of what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And it would be much easier for young people to navigate this world if they basically had some pretty clear guidelines of what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. Now, you and I hope most listeners understand that to display your sexual organs to the world to see on the internet is not a good idea. I don't remember the details, but it caused destroyed his marriage.
He was
destroyed his career.
Sending sexting, they call it.
Sexting, yeah.
But yeah, it also helped to destroy Hillary Clinton's presidential ambitions.
Yeah, it did. So
it
has.
You see that? People say every cloud has a silver lining. But when we talk about these people, Havelock Ellis, Alfred Kinsey, and then you also write about Margaret Sanger, when you describe some of the horrific things they did, where Kinsey is literally admitting to being a child molester, and you point that out to the average leftist, liberal, Democrat, whoever, they still honor him as a hero. It means nothing to them.
I think part of it, they're not aware of what's going on. Kinsey, it's interesting, he would film his students having sex with each other, with him, and with his wife, and so on. And these films are all available. I'm not sure they're available to the public, but they're available in the library in the Kinsey Research Institute at the University
Bloomington?
Of Illinois, I believe, in Bloomington.
Now, IU, Indiana University?
Indiana University. So they're there. And today, of course, that would create a big problem at the college where several colleges where I taught, they went around and they put holes in the door and put windows. And we were asking why they're doing that. And they said, well, you know, it's a problem when professors and others molest students.
Or having sex with students.
In any way, even inappropriate behavior, that's a problem. And so they want to reduce the likelihood. So we were told several times that you never, never, never be in a room with a female student, a male professor, and a female student alone with the door closed. Always at least keep the door open. And what I did to avoid, they never had those problems, fortunately, but to reduce that, I always met with students. Instead of my office, I met students in the foyer in front of our office. So therefore, whatever was said, whatever happened, anybody could see.
Yeah, very wise.
And that reduced even the potential of the problem. Mm. I had a good friend of mine who was a college professor, and he was a creationist, and they were trying to get him out. And they claimed that they had a student who basically was going to testify that indeed he had behaved inappropriately with her. And he realized that was false. He realized that wasn't true, but he also realized that could be a problem. Mm-hmm. And so he capitulated, which is what they wanted to do, and therefore he was able to avoid any further problems. But just the threat of that can be a problem in your career. But yet then, the other hand, we have all this stuff going on TV, on the internet and so on, which is a problem for young people to figure out what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. I try to err on the side of caution and anything that might be inappropriate, especially since I taught at the college level for over 40 years, I try to avoid it. So even the looking. But on the other hand,
well,
to film sexual behavior with students and professors.
Yeah.
And have it on film. And
beyond the pale, but it makes him a hero, just like Larry Flynt.
Yep.
He, pornographer. I was on Politically Correct with him on ABC's, with Bill Maher. And he writes in his autobiography of having sex with animals.
Oh.
I mean, that aside from everything else, it's even animal abuse. PETA, where's PETA when you need him?
Yeah.
But these people, no matter how despicable, he tries to get his own daughter to pose for his porn photos. No matter how despicable they are, I don't think it's what you said, Jerry. I don't think it's because people don't know, because I've spent 26 years on the air and off telling people, and they don't care. Like the people who don't care if Bill Clinton raped Juanita Broderick. Juanita, we had a world-exclusive interview with her on the show, Bob and Yurt Live. People don't care if he raped Juanita Broderick.
Well, that's part of it, but I find in working with students that part of it is they're really not aware. When you read, for example, the information about Kinsey, and some of these other people I talk about in my book, I cannot on the air relate some of the things that they did.
Right.
You would never invite me back if I related.
No.
But yet now in the book I do talk about these things, and it's pretty gross. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about sadomasochistic behavior, sadomasochism, and other behavior which involves pain, etc., that just is beyond the pale from my, but yet he was involved in this and openly talked about it, openly was
today
explained.
You get the same thing in teenage magazines like Vogue. They have Vogue for teens. Just a month ago, most horrific article explaining to young girls how to do the most vulgar, vulgar things. And it's in our libraries, no less.
Yeah.
I don't think this has ever been said on the air, but it's right in line with what you said about the way you take precautions as a teacher at college, university level. Jack Horner, he's a famous evolutionist paleontologist.
Right.
He was involved in all the Jurassic Park films. Mm-hmm. He was the consultant on set. Well, he's no longer at Montana State University and Museum of the Rockies. He was let go. He liked the young gals in his classes. And one of them, just so he can do whatever he wanted with her, they married each other. They married and divorced right away. And his argument to the administration was, well, you can't say anything because we're married.
Oh.
And so he's gone now. We offered him a grant of $23,000 to carbon date that soft tissue. Remember they got the first T-Rex soft tissue?
Yeah.
And we recorded that. It's on YouTube. We've aired it. And he said he would talk to Mary Schweitzer, but he knew we were creationists. And he thought, no, we better not do that.
Yeah.
So they refused to carbon date it, although it's been done since by others.
Well, that's good.
Okay, so Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, she was a eugenicist. She felt that we need to reduce the inferior people. And, of course, she's most well known for speaking at a KKK rally. And there's pictures of her speaking there. And she also is most well known for her efforts to reduce the black population. And she did that by, for example, convincing black preachers, ministers, to prove basically her organization and what she was doing. Most of her abortion clinics, as you know, are found in minority poor neighborhoods. And so she basically was very, very concerned about the increase in the black population, which she thought were inferior. Mm-hmm. And this is not widely known. I find it interesting that so many people today consider her a hero historically, like Hillary Clinton said she's one of the women she admires, said that in film as well as some of her writings. And so that surprised me. I think if they knew more about Margaret Sanger, probably the most, to me, memorable experience is when she married Henry C., I believe his name was, and he was the head of the Three Oil Company and was a multimillionaire. And her secretary asked her why she would marry this man who was twice her age and was a Christian as well. And she said, well, he's got $4 million and I don't know how else to get it. Mm. So she married him and she had a prenuptial agreement, which basically said that he lives in one side of the house and she lives in the other side. I had a big house, a mansion. She lives in the other side and he is not to question her and what she does and who she invites into her part of the rent mansion, etc. But Henry was, I guess, willing to do that because he was really infatuated with her when she was younger. She died, though, a very depressed old lady, very unhappy and rejected person, which surprised me that her death was such a few days before she died or a few months before she died was such a contrast to how she lived.
Jerry, on American Right to Life's website, I wrote an article titled Margaret Sanger in Her Own Words. And we embedded a little bit of audio from Margaret Sanger. And I'd like to play for you this little bit of audio. But first, before that, she wrote two books, Pivot of Civilization and Women and the New Race. Women and the New Race.
Right, yeah.
And in Pivot of Civilization, she wrote this. And we linked to it on Google Books so people could read it in context. But she wrote about the handicap. She said, the blind, deaf, dumb, mute and epileptics are the dead weight of human waste. Could you imagine referring to handicapped people as the dead weight of human waste? I've tried to get that quote on the Wikipedia article on her, and the liberals who edit with an iron fist there on Wikipedia, they don't allow it, and it gets removed. But then she also wrote this in Woman in the New Race. She wrote, the most merciful thing that the large family does to one of its infant members is to kill it.
Yeah, that's an infamous quote of hers.
That's infanticide.
Yeah.
Right. So here, maybe we could hear this audio. It's not the greatest audio, but see if you could hear this and let me know what you think.
Do you believe in sin? When I say believe, I don't mean to believe in committing sin. Do you believe there is such a thing as sin?
Well, I think the greatest sin in the world is bringing children into the world that have disease from their parents, that have no chance in the world to be a human being, practically. Delinquents, prisoners, all sorts of things just marked when they're born. That, to me, is the greatest sin.
Of course, right along the line of eugenicists, and that's what they advocated, so that's not, you know, mm-hmm. surprising. She was pretty active in the eugenics movement, and that was advocated. But Darwin himself said almost the same thing. He said, basically, why are we saving people who shouldn't be saved? Why do we use vaccines and medical mm-hmm. treatment to cure people or help people survive and then have children pass these diseases on to their offspring? And so that's not really different from what Darwin had to say. Of course, he said that probably won't happen. Well, surprise, it has happened in many countries, like Russia and Nazi Germany and so on.
So with Margaret Sanger as the founder of Planned Parenthood, of course, she advocated child killing, abortion. So how about the role of Darwinism and the advocacy of abortion?
Yeah, very, very profound role. And did a lot of research on this. In fact, one of the chapters in the book is devoted to this. And the Human Life Review, they also published my article on the relationship between Darwin and abortion. And what I found was that one strong argument they used was the fact that when an abortion occurs, the child is at the stage where it's a fish. In other words, what he did, the argument he used, and this, by the way, was a head of the Department of Genetics.
This is Haeckel's embryos.
At the University of Michigan, he used Haeckel's embryos, and he said, basically, we start out as a one-celled creature like an amoeba, and then we go through the different evolutionary stages. And during the stage, we're in the fish stage, the fish time of our development. That is when abortion usually occurs. And so you're not killing a child, you're killing basically a fish. And he argued not just it's a fish, it has gill slits like a fish, it has gills like a fish, it has the traits of a fish. And now we know that's based on Haeckel's embryos, Ernst Haeckel, who was a German biologist, and he obtained these pictures by drawing. And he drew according to what he claimed he saw through the microscope. Well, there's no way that that would be, because we know his drawings were way off. And later on, when he was confronted with this, he said, well, a little bit of artistic license, I just tweaked them a little bit to make the point stronger. Well, he didn't just make the point stronger. He basically was dishonest in preventing these embryos, which is an ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which these drawings have been in textbooks for 100 and some years. So these were used as in the Supreme Court case, and the judges were very impressed with this argument. They thought, well, it's a piece of tissue. It's a fish. It's not a live human being, so it's not killing a human because it's not at this stage a human. Therefore, this weighed in fairly strongly into their arguments. And this can be, well, my chapter covers the many references, but it's fairly clear that this impressed the judges. I think today, if this were brought, the same case were brought to the Supreme Court, I feel it'd be a very different outcome, partially because now we have ultrasound, not just ultrasound, but color, good, clear ultrasound pictures. Mm. So you can see during these early stages, it indeed is a child. It's not a fish.
This might be a good place to break. Dr. Bergman, if we could continue this on a part two, would you be available?
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, so why don't we do that? And then for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio, this is Bob Enyart. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.
Hi, this is Bob Enyart. At Real Science Radio, we have a great science store. You can get great science materials from us, DVDs, debates, books, online, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store or by calling us 1-800-8-ENYART. So here's a list of what you can get. DVDs from Illustra Media that we carry, The Privileged Planet, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and Darwin's Dilemma. And then there are the two fabulous DVDs from Dr. Carl Werner on Evolution, the Grand Experiment, Living Fossils. You'll want to see those. And then Spike Passaris, formerly with the U.S. Military Space Program, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy. Just call us at 800-8-ENYART, 800-836-9278, or check out our online store in the science department, either at kgov.com or realscienceradio.com.